Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. When the movie Network was released in theaters in 1976, you could count the number of TV channels on one hand. There was no 24-hour news, no cable, and no internet. Network was a dark satire about a news anchor who was fired for lagging ratings, who then ranted against our addiction to TV, only to become a ratings hit. And it all struck a nerve.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
Peter Finch won a posthumous Academy Award for his lead performance. Now his character of anchorman Howard Beale is being played by Bryan Cranston in a stage adaptation of Network on Broadway.
Out of your chairs right now, go to the window, open it, stick out your heads and yell. And I want you to yell, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore."
The play was adapted by Lee Hall from Paddy Chayefsky's screenplay. When I recently spoke with Cranston, he told me how he imagined Beale's life before he loses it on live TV.
When I choose projects, it's something that really moves me already. Without any effort at all, I start daydreaming about a project that I really am attracted to. And I know that's a good sign. It stayed with me. It resonated. And so I just follow those instincts in what Patty and Lee had put together. And I came up with Howard Beale being and feeling irrelevant, past his prime, that he was about to go out to pasture. And his wife has passed. He has no children. So he's basically alone. He's an island unto himself. And you'd think that that person is reaching out to find connectivity with other human beings. But to serve the play, I realized that he had to invest in his aloneness. And that deepened his sense of depression. And so it's out of that kind of low ebb that all these things are starting to transpire. In other words, he's a man without anything to lose. And then he gets fired at the top of the show. And so he's like, to heck with it all. He drinks too much. He doesn't take care of himself. He doesn't eat well. He doesn't sleep well. And he's headed for a collision course. And he does, in a way. But fortunately for him, it's more of an epiphany. He does have a sense of enlightenment that hits him, and he tries to use that as a device to be able to communicate to his viewers.
The other thing that was important about Howard Beale, and this is what Diana, who is the woman who comes in to promote his rage, says, Howard Beale sat there last night and said what every American feels, that he's tired of all the BS. BS is my word, not the play's word. He's articulating the popular rage.
And I'm not going to take it anymore.
They're yelling in Atlanta, Howard.
They're yelling in Atlanta. Let's go look. Let's look. Look at them yell. Look at them yell. Yell. Yell first.
And I think that's also where Paddy Chayefsky was on top of things, that Howard Beale is tapping into something that is almost primal. And there's a moment in the play where the audience is encouraged to share in that rage and that anger. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering where you feel that fits into its relevance and what it's like to hear the audience become as whipped up as they can be whipped up on any given night.
Well, a play is intended to entertain. But the most important thing that any storyteller, whether you're on stage or film or television, is to elicit an emotional response. I would rather have someone be angry at my performance than bored. If I don't move them to some emotion, I feel like I've failed. So in this case, Patty and our production team for the theatrical version of it, has created an instigation to be able to light a fire under people. And actually, when we get them to say, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore," It's giving them permission to be angry as a legitimate emotion. And I think our society has been lacking in that. We can accept someone who's irritated or sad or despondent, but anger has not been an embraced emotion for many, many eons. We see someone who's angry, we get away from that person. And usually, as a human being, it's appropriate to be tolerant and accepting and embracing of all different beliefs and opinions and religions and lifestyles. It is a lovely thing to do as a human being to be more open to the quirks and idiosyncrasies of human beings. But perhaps right now, in this unprecedented time in our country's history, perhaps now the appropriate emotion is anger, because anger does stimulate activity. I remember in the 60s when anger stimulated a whole movement of anti-war protests and songs and art and style and plays and movies, and it was a movement that really moved the needle and had an influence on our political leaders in that period of time. And maybe there's room for that now. And it can really help to promulgate change.
Coming up, more with Bryan Cranston about his starring role in the Broadway production of Network. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We're talking today with actor Bryan Cranston. He's currently on Broadway in a new stage adaptation of the 1976 movie Network, which was written by Patty Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. Although the movie premiered more than 40 years ago, it was oddly prescient about where network news and tabloid television were headed. Cranston plays Howard Beale, the mad-as-hell newscaster, at the center of the story.
Stick out your heads and yell, and don't stop yelling. First, you've got to get mad. And when you're mad enough, then we'll figure out what to do.
The emotion of anger and the challenge that Beale urges to his viewers is at the core of the story of both the movie and the play. The stage version, written by Lee Hall, is set in the present day, which further proves how timely Network remains. And Cranston has some thoughts on the value of anger today.
Activism is important. Movements are important. The kids down in Parkland are important. The Me Too movement is important. The Women's March is important. Black Lives Matter is important. It's all important, and a lot of that comes out of rage, out of anger. And if placed and directed properly, it can be an incredibly useful tool.
Do you find that useful as an actor? When you are trying to get wound up as the character on stage, do you summon those things that you find frustrating? Does that help you get to where you need to be?
Oh, it certainly does. I've had a challenging childhood, and I've been an actor for 40 years now, and I'm very used to opening up the cavity of my emotions to pull out whatever is necessary for any given scene or character. And I did learn early on that if you can honestly do that and show your vulnerability, even if you're showing a characteristic of your personality that is not favorable, that is not attractive, that audiences will still embrace that because they feel the legitimacy of that and the verisimilitude of that display. And that's what I try to follow. So I pull out whatever is necessary and hope that at least the audiences say that feels authentic.
One of the other things that I think this play is about paying attention and keeping your eyes open and listening to what people are saying. And I was struck by something I saw when I saw you in the play a couple of months ago. There's a moment where your character goes into the audience a couple rows deep and you're interacting with the audience. And there was a man, and I'm just ballparking his age, he's about 65 years old, and he takes out his cell phone to shoot a selfie. And I was like, you're in the middle of live theater. This is a story about paying attention and listening to what's being said, and your instinct is to document it on your iPhone and not be present in the moment. And I suspect that didn't happen just that one night. What do you see when you go in the audience, and what does it reinforce in your mind about what the play is really addressing?
Well, I think it's very astute, because that is exactly what Patty was railing against, is that we were so addicted to the tube back then, this console, this magnet in the household that drew all of our attention. We were absolutely addicted to it. Now it's far worse, because that tube is now a television that you can hold in your hand. And it's not just a television. It's your schedule maker. It's your typewriter. It's your radio. It's your camera. It's all these things. It's an amazing tool. But we have to remember that it is just a tool. And if you don't control your use of the tool, it could be misused. And then all of a sudden the tool is using you. But you're right. Every time I go into the audience, there is the level of unexpected activity. And there have been, I would say, in the 5 months that we've been doing this, I would say that once a week, I will see someone pull out a phone to try to take a picture of me while I'm in the audience. Once a week. And if they're close, I'll take it out of their hands. And I'll make a light of it. I'll look at it. And I'll say something like, well, that's a strange-looking cigarette holder, but thank you for not smoking in the studio, and hand it back to them, trying to give them the message to just listen and look. You don't have to do what you're doing.
More than 40 years ago, Patty Chayefsky and Sidney Lumet made the Movie Network, and I want to play a small clip from it. And it's Peter Finch as Howard Beale, and it's obviously a remarkable performance. But I want to listen very closely to what Patty Chayefsky's dialogue is saying.
Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube.
I think, sadly, those numbers are probably even worse today than they were when they were written. But how important to you is that idea that what Patty Chayefsky and Howard Beale were talking about then is as relevant and perhaps even more important today than it was back then?
Well, I think that's what first attracted me to it. When I heard 4 years ago, I had a lunch with Ivo van Hove, our director, in London, and he said he wanted to do this, and I was excited about it because I remembered Network from the 70s when I was in college. And it resonated then. But at the time, I took it, and I think it was intended by Patty to be satirical, that wouldn't it be strange, wouldn't it be weird if out of this addiction to whatever is the newest technology, this forms our complete and utter addiction to it, and someone can come out of that realm and lead the world. It never occurred to me until I started really to really think about doing this play that someone I revered so much in Walter Cronkite, that he would be also involved in deciding what stories are to be told and what stories are going to be omitted from the newscast. But of course, that of course it was that someone was making a decision. We're going to, you know, disclose these five or six stories, and we're going to leave these four off because we don't have the time. And whether your intentions are altruistic or not, you are perhaps guided by your own subliminal ideology that makes you decide which stories to tell and which stories you're not going to tell on any given broadcast. That kind of threw me, and I realized, oh, there's always been manipulation. There has always been a packaging of information that is distributed to the viewer, and that is never more so than it is now, where there's these encampments of so-called news outlets, but they're really opinion outlets, and they are spreading their own ideology, and we, as the listeners, tend to listen to what we all agree with and nod our heads yes. And occasionally we might go over to the other station that we don't agree with and shake our heads no, and what idiots those people are. We have engaged in kind of a ideological tribalism where we have sectioned ourselves off. And Patty wrote about that in the very last part of this play. Lee Hall wrote something that was not in the movie, that is an amalgamation of Patty Chayefsky's responses by the press when asked, why did you write Network? What does it mean to you? And his comments, among many others, were the thing that we need to fear the most is the outstanding damage and power of absolute beliefs. That we could believe anything absolutely is problematic. That we need to keep our senses open, be willing to change. For some reason now, in our environment, if someone changes their mind about something because new information has come in, they're condemned and ridiculed as a flip-flopper. And, you know, it's all this kind of attack kind of politics, which is both attractive because it's aggressive, very assertive, but it's also repulsive because it's unfair in many cases and inhumane.
Here's my last question. A lot of people listening probably won't get a chance to see you on Broadway and Network. Is there a line from the play that you would want to leave them with that means something to you?
Yes. One of the last lines I say is, the only total commitment any of us can have is to other people. That's it. It's simple. But that was written by Lee Hall, not Patty Chayefsky. It was kind of a coda, a wrap-up. But those words were spoken by Patty.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Good to talk to you.
Network with Bryan Cranston is on Broadway through June 8th. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The final season of the HBO series Game of Thrones is underway. We don't yet know who will end up taking the Iron Throne in the end, but it's safe to say that season 8 is not cutting back on death, destruction, and epic battle scenes. Back in 2016, I spoke with Tommy Dunn. He's the official weapons master for Game of Thrones. He oversees the design and manufacture of every dagger, sword, lance, and quiver of arrows that you see in the show. And he explained the intricacy of the work involved in building up the show's war chest.
These weapons, when I designed them and we make them, they have to be made to such a standard that they're a showcase. They're basically a weapon that you can put anywhere at all, you know, on any screen, in anybody's hand, and they look fantastic. They will look as opulent or as bad as they're supposed to do as per house, but towards a standard, and the standard that I expect the best, and I try and put out the best. So I'm a stickler for that, and nothing leaves my workshop unless it's exactly the way it's supposed to be and look fantastic.
You also have, in some episodes, the actual fabrication of the weapons. I want to play a scene from the first episode of season 4 from Game of Thrones. Let's listen. You know what's coming. Let's listen.
I think I know that one.
So, if you don't know what's going on here, there is a cauldron and something's being melted and two new swords are being forged. And there's a very super Buffy looking blacksmith. Who is that dude? Do you know him?
Yeah, I haven't got a clue. Nice looking guy, though. Yeah, that would be me. That would be me. Yeah, I don't know about the good looking bit, but I think the script actually had Big Brute. I'm thinking, hang on a second. I think I've been stitched up here. But yes, it was me. It was enjoyable. It was good fun. It was quite a hot set, quite a hard scene that had to be shot over a few days.
So that was, you were really melting iron there.
With the obviously amalgamation with special effects, we actually did have a cauldron and we had the heat and a furnace in there that was heating bronze. So what we did was that the actual pouring mechanism and this and the solidification of the bronze is what we use. So we're up at about 1,000 degrees in that little furnace area.
The fight scenes in the show also have great sound effects. It's metal against metal, kind of arrows whooshing through the air, the clang of armor. If we were on set and listening to the real sounds of what was happening, how different would it be and what would we be hearing?
In fairness, there wouldn't be a lot of difference. I mean, because we do tend to do as much as possible in camera, and obviously with sound, with Ronan, one of our sound guys, they're quite, you know, meticulous in their look and their sound, because we fight with a lot of aluminium. But what I like to do is that I like to make sure that the weapons are toned. So if they do clash, you get a nice cling and a nice clatter off them. Yes, there is a little bit of enhancement needed and required at times.
And it's also important what it's made out of. There are some weapons that are made out of Valyrian steel. I'm going to play a clip from a fight with the White Walker War at the end of season 5. So in this scene, Jon Snow is able to kill one of these White Walkers,
yeah. And
that's because he has a sword named Longclaw. Tell us about Longclaw and why it is able to do what it's able to do.
We have the mythical powers of the Valyrian steel, that all the Valyrian steel or any weapon that has Valyrian steel has some sort of power. Now, we don't tend to know what that power is until it suddenly happens. That's the first time we've seen, obviously in season 5 there, that this weapon that disintegrates, that the White Walkers, their translucent sword, so they have it's like a shard of ice, and it seems to be that this shard of ice cuts everything through and bodies, decimates everything in its wake. It's totally, you know, invincible until it met the first blade that was a Valyrian steel. But you don't just turn around and go, yes, this Valyrian steel, it cuts through everything. Well, we don't know that until it, like I say, it just happens at that particular time.
And how do you go about making something as intricate as the White Walker spear?
That was quite a tricky one, because originally it was supposed to be visual effects all the way through onto the pilot.
And then to make it look like ice, right?
To make it look like ice. And then what happened was, I think the budget was a bit crazy, and I was told within 2 weeks of the actual shoot that I had to make one. So a little bit of panic set in to a certain degree, as you can understand, thinking, what am I going to do? I knew where I wanted to go, but the problem was trying to figure out the proper chemical or the proper material that would be strong, that would be translucent. Probably on the 11th hour, I found the proper material. So it's a nice resin. And again, we were very lucky. We were shooting in Iceland prior to that. And we've seen some of these stalagmites and stalactites, and I took some pictures of them and picture reference, and they were beautiful. So try to emphasize and try to keep that within the sword.
If I were to go back and look at your childhood, were you playing a pirate on Halloween at age 4? Was there anything in your childhood that made it clear that you were going to be a weapons master as an adult? And how did you get into this job?
But just pure luck, really. I mean, I knew a few people needed an extra pair of hands, and I started on a small movie in Ireland. I think you might have heard it before, called Braveheart.
I think I heard about that one. A guy named Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson. So again, that was my first introduction into weaponry for the film industry, and again, I loved it. Such a great job, great people. I wanted more of it, basically. So I went from there.
Tommy Dunn is the weapons master for Game of Thrones. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us from Ireland.
Absolute pleasure, John.
New episodes of Game of Thrones air Sunday nights on HBO, as if you didn't already know that. And that's our show for today. I'm Sean Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.